You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Welcome back. How is it being back in New York?
Stinky.
Truly? Darkly?
Is that good? Are you into that? Why is it stinky?
I know. It just was like raining yesterday. So I was like, ooh, I'll sit outside and watch the rain. And I did. And I was like, it smells good like rain and also like pee. And I was like, it feels like that's something you have to be okay with here. And then I went on, we walked to the car. We went to Costco. And on the way to the car, I was like, yeah, it smells like rain and pee in the street too. I was like, yeah, I'll take it.
It is funny to come back from other parts of the United States and to come back to New York and be like, wow, we're really doing it on hard.
We're really doing it hard. We mean it here. And I like it.
I like I like the effort that it takes to exist in New York.
To be alive. You have to be awake. You have to be on guard.
You have to walk. You have to smell. You have to interact. You have to subway.
Yeah. Although I had a very New York, I felt, interaction on the airplane here, which may be because we were flying to Jersey. So it was like, you're already back. Which was that I was like, got to my seat and the woman behind my seat had hung her sweatshirt completely over my seat in a way where I would
absolutely
have to like lie against her sweatshirt. So inappropriate. So I was like, oh, this is my seat. And she just looked at me blankly. And it might have been a language thing. So I wasn't like mad. I was just like, oh. And
I want to know how you interpret, how you charaded it.
And I said this, I'm like next to my kids and they're filing into the window and I'm on the aisle. And I was like, how am I going to, I got to get this off my seat. And the guy that was getting in his seat ahead of me was like, what? And I was like, oh, I just don't want to put my face on her sweatshirt. And he goes, well, are you going to sit backward with your face against the seat?
Wait, a stranger said this to you? Not even a man? Wait, fuck
a stranger.
Him.
A stranger. And I was like, oh. And I just looked at him like, what? Nobody wants somebody else's. Like, I'm not being rude, sir. Like,
that's so crazy.
I just
were
looked
gaslit.
At him and like, I just looked at him like, you are so lucky my kids are with me. And then I turned to the woman and I just kindly lifted her jacket slowly so she could see, like, I'm handing you your jacket. I don't know if it's a language barrier, but
this is not
a coat rack. This is my seat. So I like slowly lifted it and handed it to her in a very mellow, kind way. Mm-hmm. And she was, I think, like, she didn't seem mad, but I was like, that
weird.
Was so weird that that guy was like,
it's weird that he sided with her. It's really weird that he sided with her.
Yeah, because it was so clear. Like,
also, it's not even his business. Like, that's the other thing that was weird, is that, like, he didn't have to say shit. Here's the thing is what I love is, like, insert in the movie of this, insert Quinn on of camera phone on an iPhone video of her getting in a fight with a woman about a jacket.
Oh my god, I would.
It does feel a little like not Larry
with my
David.
Kids. I'm telling you, not with my kids. I try to keep it cool, keep it fresh,
keep it calm, keep it cool, funky. Keep it collected.
I like to sit next to Griff on an airplane. And you do watch Dexter and just roll that dice.
And he goes, Mama, what's that?
No, is that- he doesn't.
He goes, what's Will? He goes, what's Will doing?
He, yeah, he loves. It wasn't that one. It was if they had that one, I would have done it. It was New Blood, I think, or something. Mm.
I don't know. I haven't seen it. I've heard tell of him.
It's
on
like
it.
The old days, him when he's younger, and Christian Slater's his dad. Is
it's
Harry.
Crazy. It's crazy that there's been this many spin-offs.
This many
of
Dexters. But you know what? It's a really fun formula. Like I really am. Like formula. I know exactly You're what wrong. This will be. I love,
and I'm in
hearing an inner monologue now that you's over. I don't have that. Like you did Dexter. Dexter did Dexter. I'm ready. Like I always need another
so
Dexter.
Even when he's a child, they do inner monologue.
Of course,
that's like the consistent. Yes. Is there any other show? You know who else does inner monologue? Sex
Carrie
and the
Bradshaw.
City.
Yeah.
Quinn was
she
ready.
She was a serial killer. She didn't really do her real inner monologue. We all know that if you have a really loud inner monologue like that, you are a serial killer.
Maybe Carrie is a serial killer. She's definitely a serial dater.
They can definitely. What did you feel about her new show getting canceled?
Can I tell you, this is you heard it here first. I actually have only watched like part of the first season. I didn't watch the show. Here's the thing. I lived in Sex and the City land for years. And if I bring the show back, my show One Woman Sex and the City, for anybody who's new who doesn't know that I did a show called One Woman Sex and the City where I did all six seasons of Sex and the City. It'd be weird if you didn't know at this point. But I'll have to rewatch that. I'll have to watch that show. I think the thing I felt about it was I was like, oh, the first six seasons are such like, ugh, perfect. Like that's...
Like, why did we bring them back?
But I get why we bring them back. Like,
you know why?
Because I get it.
We have,
I get it.
Our 30s are perfect and we're so beautiful and young and dating. And then people are like, enough of you, but we have to keep living. And we're like, sorry, I'm still
we
here.
Exist.
I'm still
we
trying
exist
to
outside.
Put on a Luke. I'm still trying to like go to a cute restaurant that doesn't want me there.
Yeah, no, I feel that. By the way, I'm really excited for you and your family to come over next week.
Yeah, me too.
I'm really excited. I think I'm going to make you guys fish. If you're not going to be Great. So sick of fish that week because it's going to be fish or fish. But yeah, I'm excited to make food and I'm going to give your kids diabetes and I'm just really excited.
Diabetes.
I can't wait Drink to give your kids diabetes. Drink your juice. I'm going to give them apple juice. I'm going to make brownies or cookies. I don't know which ones yet, but your kids. I already thought of it. I'm like, I'm going to make them a separate mac and cheese, and they're going to love it.
Wow. You are excited.
I'm really excited to see them.
You're in it to win it.
I'm in it to win it. Well, here's the deal. We can tell the folks who are listening, like, yeah, Quinn and I caught up. There are things I cannot put in the podcast. Maybe in the future, you'll hear it.
But everything's for sale. Just remember that.
But everything's for
Everything
sale.
Everything has a price.
Maybe should I reveal on the Patreon that It'll we record be, today?
Yeah, totally.
Because who's paying for that? Just people who are real ones.
Yeah.
Real fucking fans.
Yeah.
Okay.
They deserve cool. it.
They deserve to know. Yeah.
We were in Breckenridge and there was like an art festival there. And it was cool because you could walk into different cute little areas in the town and they'd have a craft for your kids to do.
Oh, fun.
And my kids did, we were up there for four nights. They did a craft every day. We'd go into town and I'd be like, do you want to go into this place? They're making binoculars. And when they did a craft, it was like an hour where I was like, you're really like getting the kids to do these like kind of in-depth deals.
That's impressive.
Yeah. And the people hosting it were like artists that were into it. And we're like, we're making this craft. So my kids did all these crafts and they have all kinds of installations. So there's hikes that you go on and people are playing music on the hiking trail, suspended from trees like really crazy
wow.
things. There was one hike that we went on that we didn't go into that, but I did see pictures of it. It looked cool. We did go on a hike, though, to a sound bath. That was in the middle of the woods that was straight Whoa. Up a mountain and then you got there and it was an artist that had created an auditory sound bath, seven sources of sound that were supposed to be his artistic interpretation of how trees talk to each other underground, like the systems. And so
it was, Avatar.
Yes. Yeah. It was called Avatar. It was Papyrus. It was
James, and it was, the artist was James Cameron.
Yes. Do you know him?
I do. I'm
so
familiar.
We were in the middle of the woods listening, and Griff was like, I'm so scared. And then he went up to the artist who was there, and he goes, is this supposed to be very scary? Which was really cute. Yeah, it was great.
I really love that. I love that kid. There, yeah, I said it. I'll never so say great. It again. I love that kid. I feel so embarrassed great. Even saying it.
I know. I won't
Wait,
tell him.
Don't tell him. It'll go straight to his head, and he'll be like, I am Prince. I can do anything.
I wanted to tell you about the Breckenridge art thing, is mm-hmm. that they end up advertising that there's this thing, and they wrote about it in the Summit News, and you're reading about it, and it's like, this artist has created a show called Spark that is a reinvention, a reimagining of what a firework can be, because fireworks cause air pollution, they scare dogs. What if the kinds of fireworks we did were completely silent and beautiful and mesmerizing and were biodegradable? And you're like, oh, that's really interesting. Go on. And no joke, the guy's like, by using design and technology, I have created 1 million biodegradable light sparks that will be silently carried on the wind. Like, this is going to be a way to connect to nature, a way to connect to each other. And for hours, you're going to be able to look above you, and covering the sky 100 feet up will be these sparks that I've created that are completely biodegradable. It's going to be magical. It's going to be incredible. And I'm telling you, the text on it was a full newspaper article, and the thing he put in the artist bio stuff or whatever, where you're reading about what you can see in Breckenridge, he uses the word spark no less than like 30 times. And he's like, this could replace fireworks. And so I'm telling the kids, I'm like, you guys, I feel like we're about to see a piece of the future. It's really late at night because they have to wait for it to get dark. It starts at 9:30. Your bedtime is 8. We're going. Like, can you handle it? And they're like, yes. And I'm like, great. So we bring a blanket. We drive to town. We like, my parents go to bed earlier than that too. We're all staying up because we're like, we're about to witness the future.
History.
Oh, that was the other thing. He was like, I have toured internationally. We were last in Singapore. Whoa. This is the
and
U.S.
Singapore is classy as shit.
And he's like, the U.S. Debut is in Breckenridge. And you're like, that seems impossible, but here we are, and I'm ready for it. And they're like testing this thing that the rest of the world has seen. Let's do this. So we show up and we like lie on our blanket and we're like, let's do this. He's set up all these things around us that the lights are suspended on that he's going to use. And there's bubble machines. And they're spraying, the like pre-show is just like, there's 1 million bubbles being sprayed above you, which was already cool. I was like, this is already cool. This is so fun. I can't wait. So spraying bubbles, my kids are like, cool, cool, cool. And then the lights turn on and they change colors. So like, there'll be like a bathing of a yellowish green light, then a bathing of like a bluish one. And as they're turning on, they're lighting up the bubbles, which looks really cool. And you're like, fun. And then at around like, at some point, that's been going on for like 10 minutes. And I'm like, when is this thing going to start? And then my mom's like, Quinn, this is the thing. And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like,
I knew it.
I think this is the thing. And I was like, and we were listening to the kids next to us with their parents. And I heard the kids say the same, like, when is it going to start? And the mom goes, it did. This is it. And he goes, what? Bubbles? And she goes, yeah. And everybody was kind of like, oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
It is very cool looking. You sprayed 1 million bubbles into the air and you're lighting them. So it has this firefly effect of like catching the transparency and making it really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, let me be clear.
Mm-hmm. It was cool.
It was gorgeous.
But to compare,
I have a huge issue with the marketing. I have an enormous issue with a man telling me that he has reimagined fireworks and that he has found a way to create biodegradable sparks. What the fuck is wrong with you? Why would you not be like, I'm doing a bubble and lights show?
Quinn,
he does not use the word bubble.
The
word bubble is not once in any marketing. The word bubble. And I'm like, did you think it was copyrighted? The word bubble? Is there a reason you avoided saying the thing that you were doing? Do we think this is fair?
Did you pay to do it?
No.
Okay. Then I think, you know what?
But what's with the like, you know what you're doing. You had to get on Amazon and buy those bubble machines. So you know that they're bubbles. There's dudes walking out during it, refilling them with big things that say like bubble soap. You know exactly what you're doing. Why do you think you can pull one over on the public and have us be like, he invented this thing? You're blowing bubbles.
You're blowing
bubbles.
It's fine
that you're blowing bubbles. Yeah. It's very pretty, but what's with the pompous, like,
reimagining
text fire. Of,
you know what, though, marketing is everything, baby. Because the thing is if somebody was like, hey, come to this place, keep your kids up late, and we're going to watch a massive bubble show, would you go?
Yeah, maybe. It's in
No, you would. Don't. I don't know. I mean, you might, but you would have.
I might.
You know what it is? You would have planned it. Here's what happened. You would have planned it, and then the day of, you would have been like, you know what, we're really tired. I don't know if we should do this for bubbles. And you wouldn't have hyped the kids up. You would have kept expectations, like, in a reasonable level.
I turned to Koa, who got to stay up late and was, like, in the middle of town dancing, and I was like,
oh.
Hey, Koa, was this worth it? And he goes, oh, staying up? And I go, yeah. And he goes, well, I do wish it was a little cooler. And I was
I love
spoken so truthfully, the mouth of a babe.
From the mouth
everyone's
of a babe,
thinking
but still,
it.
Can I say though, still so thoughtful, like still a really sweet way. By the way, I got to tell you, my mom called me after one of the episodes where you talked about the kids jet skiing, and I got a call from my mom, and just goes, "Oh my god, I had to call." She goes, "That Quinn, she cracks me up." She goes, 7-year-old riding a jet ski? What?
Well, why not?
Why not?
Why not?
It was very
We're
fun
all going to die one day.
You know what? And maybe we expedite the process. I don't know. I don't know. The
don't
world
know.
Seems pretty scary. I don't know. I'm not telling you what to do. Just
what's,
what you're
what's there
doing.
To live for? A biodegradable spark show? That's just a fucking 8 bubble machines tilted
right?
upward with fans?
Am I right or am I right? So that's kind of that. Anyway, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creamply.
Who goes
I'm Carrie
Ipama.
And that's
Quinny
Quinlan Paz. And it's Quinny Quinn Quinn Quinn. And I go first today.
Aww.
Aww. Aww, nuts. Wait, which one did I want to do? No, that's the teeny tiny creeply. Okay.
Get it straight, Carrie.
I know. I got to get it straight. Don't get it crooked. I got this information, I just paused. I got this information from Hell on Earth, the Veronica case, Think Spain, the Olive Press, and El País. So I'm going to take you back to 1998, and I want to introduce you to Veronica. She's 13 years old, and she lives in Benahuzar, Spain. And her mom asks her to go to the market to grab some bread and come home. And mm-hmm. she goes to the market. She's wearing a tracksuit, goes to the shops, comes home. And on her way, she is stopped by this man, a neighbor of hers, Antonio Cosme, who they called who the town calls Pincelito. He's a beloved man in town. He's 62 or 63 years old. Mm-hmm. He holds a knife to her neck. He binds her. He rapes her. She's 13 years old. She's absolutely terrified. She recognizes him. She knows who this man is. And the only reason he lets her go is because she tells him that she will never tell anyone if he just lets her go.
Huh.
She's like, I won't say anything to anyone. Please just let me go, please. He has her hands tied behind her back. She says, you have granddaughters my age. I promise I won't tell anyone. And he says, if you tell anyone, I'm going to kill you and your whole family. Okay. Now, when she makes this promise, her hands are behind her back.
And she's crossing her fingers?
Yeah.
Nice.
Because she didn't want God to be mad at her for lying.
Yeah.
So she runs home. And she immediately tells her mom, Marie Carmen, and she says, Mom, I swore I wouldn't say anything, but I crossed my fingers behind my back. Veronica tells,
oh, God, can you like imagine this 13-year-old child? Like, don't worry, I figured out a way to do this with morality.
And Marie Carmen is just absolutely shocked, and she takes her daughter Veronica to the hospital. Marie Carmen recalls her being very cold, and it is October in Spain, and it's very hot at that time. But she recalls her daughter shaking like she's in shock. They take her clothes, they put it in a bag, and Veronica will recall that it was her favorite outfit, and she was just sad to see it leave. She's crying. There's a forensic doctor who walks in, Miss Faustino, and she says that they will catch this man no matter what. Veronica is then brought home. Her sister showers her, and Veronica falls asleep. Her mom, Marie Carmen, she's up all night. She cannot go to sleep, and she's feeling absolutely just horrified about what happened to her daughter. And so the next morning, Marie Carmen goes to the community church, and she tells the priest that this man attacked their daughter. Mm-hmm. It's 1998, and people did not really believe victims. So what happens is, instead of rallying around this child, this 13-year-old who was raped, which, by the way, there was Antonio's semen found on her underwear. Mm-hmm. So there is evidence, there is forensic evidence that he attacked her. Mm-hmm. The community starts defending Antonio Cosme. They start saying they start questioning what this 13-year-old did to make this 63-year-old man attack her.
What?
The police came to get Veronica, to bring her to the police station to investigate, to ask questions, and or to take her to the place of the attack. But Marie Carmen wouldn't let them, and she's like, no, let me go. She goes to the place of the attack, and she will go on to visit that place time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
When she first goes back to the spot of the attack, she sees the bags of bread that her daughter was carrying there still. Like, it's just the visceral. I'm trying to illustrate that Marie Carmen had this visceral emotional response to this. Yeah. And mm-hmm. was met with such rage. And then to further just kick this family while they're down, the community did not believe them.
Yeah.
They have so much evidence. Then Antonio's daughter, she comes to a lawyer and she's like, hey, look, my father is being accused. And when I saw him at the detention center, I came to the conclusion that nothing was clear at all. So they hire an attorney to start fighting these charges. Veronica's family said, we just ask for justice or for him to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
Feels fair.
Totally.
Feels fair. But a little bit about Antonio Cosme, Pincelito, as the town calls him, is he bred pigeons. He's very well liked by neighbors. They would interview friends and family and neighbors of his, and all of them were unconvinced of his wrongdoing, despite the mounds of forensic evidence, including semen that matches his DNA found on these 13-year-old girls' underwear. He apparently was an excellent worker. He supported his family. People would vouch for him. Part of the support of him was that this is in Spain, and in this small town, it's like 3,000, 4,000 people, Marie Carmen and Veronica and their family, they're outsiders. They're not from this town originally, whereas Antonio Cosme, not only is he from this town, his dad was a very big part of the Spanish Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So his dad was like a hired assassin, and he protected the fascists in his town, even though he was part of the communist, in terms of the political landscape of it, is like his father was a very well-known war hero or someone who participated in the war. And so the town rallied behind this family because of the power they had. Additionally, I mean, I think we should also take into account the fact that, you know, people don't believe women, even if the woman is a girl and she's 13 years old. Veronica, right after this happened, she tried to go back to school. She tried to live a normal life, or tried to get back into a sense of normalcy. And because she went back to school, people thought she was lying. Mm. Apparently there's a story of like she was doing hurdles in gym class and the people were like, oh, you're doing hurdles? You couldn't have possibly been raped. That's not possible. And what they also were saying is kids were repeating what their parents were saying. So because this small town heard about this, as soon as she, you know, she accused Antonio of this, he was put in a detention center, right? It was like a pretty fast moving case. They had the perpetrator. He was arrested. But then everybody came to his support. And this young girl and her family were not believed. So Veronica was at school. The kids were taunting her, telling her she was faking it. And she ran out and she goes to the mayor's office of her town to talk to him. And apparently she got so angry that she started tearing his office up, this 13-year-old girl. And her mom gets a call. They pick her up. They decide Veronica should go to live in her aunt and uncle's place a little while away because then she can not be treated so poorly. And when she's away from school, people don't know. So she's able to sort of live kind of a normal life for a little while. The next year, she returns home and she decides to go to a school farther away who might not know a lot of the people in the town. But of course, by the end of the year, they hear rumors and then she starts getting bullied again where she drops out. Mm-hmm. It's November 28th, 2000. It's the trial. And what's really wild about this time is that there's no protections for this child. In fact, Veronica, so brave, so fucking brave. She's 14, 15 at this time. She walks into the courthouse and there is no barrier between her and the accused. So she recalls testifying in court about what happened to her and how he bound her, attacked her. Just for the record,
just in front of him.
She heard him snorting in the back. Ugh. Behind her. To just further emphasize the severity of the attack, she had split lips. She had knife marks on her face. She had bruises all on her body. Like this was so clearly an attack. Her attorney sees that the defense is badgering young Veronica. Antonio is like, I never penetrated, although I did fondle her. And in this court, what happened is they were like, well, it was not penetration, so it's not rape. And then they find that her hymen has not been ruptured. So they're claiming that's indicative that there was no penetration. And again, like it's 1998, they don't have enough evidence, but everybody assumes if your hymen is intact, there's been no penetrative sex, which we now know is a lie, is not fucking real. Fortunately, he is found guilty and he is sentenced to 9 years in prison for the rape. Now, when he was convicted, they thought, hey, maybe the town will now see that he's guilty and they'll support Veronica, but that doesn't fucking happen. So Marie Carmen, her mother, she stops going out. She's seemingly rejected by society. And it's heartbreaking. Like I said before, she would go and walk to the site where the attack happened often. And this mother feels guilty. She feels responsible. She will later say, like, don't ever ask your kids to go get bread. You'll regret it for the rest of your life. It's 2004. And Marie Carmen is going to run an errand and she goes to the bus stop. It's June 13th and she's waiting on the bench and she's looking down, waiting for the bus to arrive. And she just hears a man say, good morning, ma'am. How are your daughters doing? And the voice sounds familiar. And she looks up and she sees Antonio, her daughter's attacker. He was in the penitentiary level, so he was eligible to be reintegrated into society. And they didn't tell this family that he was furloughed. Additionally, they didn't tell him he couldn't approach the victim. Mm. The law didn't require it. He was free to approach them or he didn't. No, it was, yeah, horrifying. So he leaves, Veronica comes, and she sees her mom is having this massive panic attack. So Veronica goes and she drops her mom off home, which like very close to the bus station. In fact, this part of town is where Veronica, Marie Carmen, their family lives. This is not where Antonio lives. So there's nearly no reason he should be there. Marie Carmen tells Veronica, she's like, he's in that bar right there. And she's like, okay, mom. She's like, go, I'm going to bring you home. I'm going to just go home. Young Veronica comes back. This is 6 years later. She's 19. She decides to look into the bar and she hides behind a column and she sees him. he sees her and she just leaves. She gets a bus ticket and she goes. Mm-hmm. This bar is so close to their family home, and Marie Carmen is home and she knows where he is, and she's just getting more and more and more agitated. She goes to a gas station. She has a plastic bottle. Marie Carmen recalls someone saying, "What are you doing? Put a euro of gas in." And so she has this plastic bottle. She fills it up with a euro of gas and she goes into the bar. The bar owner sees her and he tells her to stop. And she says, "I just want to say hello to him." And then she says, "You're going to keep a memory of me." And she has this bottle of gas and she's just splashing it. She's splashing it. She's splashing it everywhere. It's on her. It's on him. It's on, you know, somebody else at the bar. And some of this gets on a bystander. He smells and he goes, "That's not water. That's gas." She reaches in her pocket and she pulls out matches. Someone tries to rustle it away. The bottle of gas falls on the ground. It spills. She reaches in her pocket, grabs the matches. This matchbox, it's hard to light a match. In fact, when she's trying to light her stove, it takes 20 times to mm-hmm. try and light the match. She mm-hmm. said it happened on the first one. She lights the match. Someone pushes it. It falls down. All of a sudden, the floor erupts. It spreads quickly. Mm-hmm. Antonio is engulfed in flames. There's an extinguisher nearby. People are just covering him with the extinguisher, trying to smother the flames. He's in the bathroom. He's throwing water on his face. He was burned on 60% of his body. He's asking for water. Marie Carmen runs away. She disappears, and she just starts walking. She doesn't look back. She just starts walking. Mm-hmm. Antonio is taken by emergency responders, and they know who did this, so they start looking for her, and they don't know where she is. They're worried she's going to kill herself, and they find that she just kept walking. They find her, and her hands are in her head, and she's in the middle. She just was totally distraught. She was, like, totally in shock. Mm-hmm. They take her to a civil guard station, and they treat her pretty well. She was in poor health, they noticed. She was never handcuffed. She was crying, and she was asking if her daughter was okay. They did not ask her for a statement. They said it was very clear she was not in a position to make a statement. The doctor gives her a shot, and she falls asleep. She will say later, "It was him or my Veronica, and I can't let him kill my family. Him." Veronica sees her mom, and she's like, "My mom said she doesn't remember anything." Antonio is hospitalized. He is in critical condition. Veronica will tell reporters, because they're interviewing, and this case is now widely known. Veronica tells reporters that she doesn't want him to die. She will tell that to friends too, because she's like, "It would be really bad for my mom if he died." Mm-hmm. And the news reporter, it was so chilling, and I thought it was so dark, but it bears repeating. The reporter who was interviewing her at this moment asked her, "Do you forgive him?" And her response, "Well, he never apologized." Isn't that, I mean, it's just, sorry, that part was so poignant, because we have this mm-hmm. person who, like, this 13-year-old girl who was attacked. Mm-hmm. It's just horrific. Mm-hmm. 10 days later, Antonio dies in the hospital. And Marie Carmen's charge went from attempted murder to murder. She says she's not a murderer, that she just wanted to burn his private parts. But now she's on trial for murder. While she's waiting in jail, she ends up getting probation for a year, and they grant her probation without bail. And the reunion between her and her family is very exciting. But she was still ostracized by her community. However, this case made national headlines in Spain and across the world, and she became a hero of sorts.
Yeah.
People started calling her Mother Courage, and that she was just acting like any mother would and should. Mm-hmm. What was wild in this moment is when they're having these legal discussions, mm-hmm. just to put some context on it, a finer point, is like the family of these two people are in the same room. The craziness that, like, Veronica, a victim, is in the same room as his family, and it's just the amount of wrongdoing. It was so shocking to recall that. And so they ended up having Veronica sit in with her mom at a lot of these legal meetings. At the trial, the defense will say that she was triggered into a moment of temporary insanity by him asking, "How is your daughter?" Mm-hmm. The prosecution will say that there are no witnesses that he ever said that. Veronica, at one point, was accused of being an accomplice and aided in helping her mother do this. Mm-hmm. The prosecution will say that it was a premeditated crime, that she planned it. Defense will say that it's not premeditated. It was a crime of passion. It was a crime of temporary insanity. And that, like, the matches, he actually had an opportunity to get away and she could have burned herself. It wasn't premeditated because there were so many risks and it wasn't a perfect crime, perhaps. Also, an interesting part of the defense is that they were like, there were 20 extinguishers put on Antonio when he was burned, and you shouldn't necessarily put extinguisher chemicals right on a victim. And they think that maybe what he did is the chemicals burned his esophagus. So they're like, while he needed to be extinguished from the extinguisher, maybe it wasn't the burn that actually killed him. Maybe it was the extinguisher, which could have possibly helped in their case in some way. The verdict comes out and she is sentenced to 9.5 years in prison for the murder charge. The defense, the penalty should have been 20 to 25 years. So perhaps they were more lenient with a lower sentence. That being said, is that they appealed this to the Supreme Court. Marie Carmen will say that if he didn't come after her, he would still be there. The Supreme Court ended up reducing her sentence to 5.5 years because they considered the temporary mental disorder that she was a sick person and that she shouldn't necessarily be in prison because it's not someone who's going to do this again. Then they requested a full pardon. And what was interesting is this was around the time like social media was happening. It's in the late aughts or the tens. And so a lot of people started hashtagging pardon for Marie Carmen. Mm-hmm. They got signatures on petitions from all over Spain, Barcelona, Madrid. They also got letters of support from the US, from Canada, from Mexico, from Guatemala. And she, at this point, she's just waiting for her prison sentence to start or not, because they allowed her to stay out of prison while they waited for the appeal process to finish, if she were to go to jail or not. She talked about this moment being torturous because it was like, if they didn't come and grab me and bring me to prison, I would have gone myself because the back and forth was so exhausting.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, she did not get a pardon. She never gets a pardon. And in 2013, she goes to prison. They wanted to make an example out of her, that they couldn't pardon her because then they would have been condoning vigilante justice. Mm. When she goes to prison, they cheer for her. She ends up making friends in prison. It's a high security prison, so her family can visit her once a week. Mm-hmm. And in 2017, she was released after 3.5 years of her sentence, and she was granted parole, where this is an interesting thing, where she'd be released at 11 o'clock in the morning, and then she'd have to return at 7 p.m. to sleep every night. And keep in mind, this is nearly 20 years after the initial attack of her daughter. Mm-hmm. This is how long this ordeal has gone on. She was due for full release in 2018, and she's been free since. In lieu of a biography, they made this documentary, Hell on Earth, The Veronica Case, which is on HBO, if you're interested. And I do want to leave with Veronica because I do think she's an incredibly strong and resilient woman. She worked really hard to get better, and she talks about how that was used against her because she wasn't the perfect victim. They wanted her to cry in a corner, and she wasn't doing that. She ended up going and taking judo classes, MMA, boxing, also she could defend herself. Her mom recalls her coming home and having bruises all over her body, and she worked really hard to continue with her life. And yet society still cast doubt on her and didn't believe her story. But she worked hard, and she's a hairdresser now. And in the documentary, you see the two of them, mother and daughter, together. But this is a story of just a mother's love, and just it's just horrific circumstances. It's so sad for this family. Their whole life was affected. And that's a story of Maria del Carmen Garcia.
That's a really sad story. But
yeah,
I'm proud of that mom for lighting that guy on fire.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I'd have done the same.
I think we all would have wanted to do the same.
My story is from Forensic Files, Newsweek, Cinemaholic, and an LA Times article that was really great by Christopher Gofford. We're going to start in October of 1984 in South Pasadena, California. Fire.
Is there a fire there right now?
There is a fire happening on October 10th inside Olay's home center. It's a hardware store.
Okay.
And the store gets totally destroyed. Four people are killed in this fire. One is a 2-year-old, Matthew.
No.
And his grandma, Ada. There's also a mom that gets killed that has two kids. There's also a 17-year-old kid that works there that dies. It's like the saddest group of people. Why can't just horrible people die in fire like your story? Instead, we have to have like...
Yeah. Fire, man, it spreads. It knows no bounds.
Yeah. So they come to investigate the fire and they're like, this was an electrical issue. But John Orr, who is basically at the time known as a god, that's what I read among arson investigators, shows up and he's like, you guys are being way too quick to label this an electrical fire. I think that this was arson. And they listen to him because his specialty is catching what are called fire bugs, folks that set fires. Mm-hmm. And
sounds like a cute name for a really shitty thing.
Yeah. Fire bug. Yeah, it is. That's so interesting. It sounds so passive, but it is.
It kind of sounds like the bubbles you were talking about.
Yes. You're like, just call it an arsonist. But he has this motto that he always says where he says, the bug is in the crowd. So he's like, let's look around. He has been behind catching more than 40 serial arsonists. And he tries to look into their methods, their psychology. There have been articles that he's been a part of that have been in the American Fire Journal. He's a non-smoker, as you might imagine. And he has in his office a cigarette box that has a skull and crossbones on it to basically be like, this is dangerous. He's Smokey the Bear.
He's Smokey the Bear the human.
When they listen to John Orr, they're like, John Orr, we apologize. You were right. We're too quick to label this. And it seems like there was some polyurethane used on the scene and the fire moved very quickly because of that. And that might have been why lives were lost. So he's not the only guy looking into fire bugs and arsonists. There is a man named Marvin Casey who is looking into this and realizing that a lot of the fires around that are suspicious are happening in California right around the times, oddly enough, of fire conferences. So there'll be an arson investigation conference in a neighborhood, and then there'll be a fire in that same neighborhood shortly after or around. An example is a Kraft Mart in Bakersfield. Someone had thrown, what are they called? Incendiary devices? Someone had thrown one into some artificial flowers at this Kraft Mart and it caught on fire. The device itself was made of a cigarette, matches, and a piece of notebook paper that they had used all these things to make. Now, the notebook paper has a partial print on it. So they try to figure out the fingerprint, but the technology is just not there. So they can't.
It's crazy to me that they can find a fingerprint from something that's been burned. That's so fucking insane.
Yeah.
That's so cool. It's
really good. But at the time, this is right near.
Right.
Again, an arson investigation conference. So Casey is telling everybody, I have a theory, and I really think that it's one of the people at the conference. It could be an insurance investigator. It could be a fire investigator. It could be an attorney. It's one of the people that was at the conference, but I really, really think it's one of them. Then it happens again in 1989 near a conference in Monterey. The same thing. And he's like, I know I'm onto something. So what I want to do first is take the list of who was at the first conference and the list who was at the second conference and who was at both. And he gets 10 names from doing that. One of the names is John Orr, that fire investigator. And he's like, I bet it's this guy because he's super into investigating these fires. So let me see that fingerprint we have. And they can't make it match. They can't make it match the print. So everyone's like, Guy, you got to relax on this. But by spring of 1991, a couple of years later, the technology's better and they do match that print.
To John Orr. No.
Yes. And so everybody's like, wait a minute. Was he one of the investigators? And it's like, yes. And then it becomes like, you guys, he could have touched it because he's an investigator. Oh. So behind the scenes, the department is like, stop letting John Orr touch shit. If he shows up to investigate, don't let him touch the evidence because this is getting really confusing, you guys. And we don't know what we're up against.
Don't let him touch it. He's just the bug is always in the crowd. The bug is always in the crowd.
The bug's in the crowd.
And they're like, don't touch
that, John. So
John's a real handsy guy.
What they end up doing is putting a tracking device on him to be like, maybe we can figure out where he's going and this will work. So then he's leaving a fire conference in May of 1991 in San Luis Obispo. And he figures out that there's some sort of tracking device on his car, but he doesn't know it's a tracking device. He thinks it's a bomb. So he freaks out and he drives to a explosives range that the police own. And he calls them and is like, there's a bomb on my car and I'm freaked. And so they come
and they're like, what is this? That's so crazy.
And they're like, John, that was a hoax. Somebody was hoaxing you. Someone was joshing you. Don't worry about it. Okay. And he's like, oh, that was pretty weird. Meanwhile, in the same year of 1991, he's been writing a manuscript for a book. He's been taking a writing class at Glendale Community College. John has hobbies.
He didn't do it because he seems kind of fun and nice.
His book is called Points of Origin. And the guy in the book that's the main character is named Phil. And he's an arson investigator in L.A., and then there's another guy in the book named Aaron, who is a pyro who gets off sexually by setting fires. And he used to be a firefighter, so he knows a lot about fires, and that can help him stay undercover. And the way that he makes the devices is that he uses a lit cigarette that burns down, catches on glue, and it's like this little bomb basically where it's going to start a fire and he has 10 minutes to leave the scene. And there's a part in the book where he takes one of those and he puts it inside cushions at a store in Pasadena called Cal's, and four people die.
So it seems a little suspiciously similar
to life, but this did happen. It's also like there's a part of you that's like, is he writing? He wasn't writing it, and then it happened. It happened, and then he wrote it. It's not like he's not soothsaying. He's being like, I investigated this fire, and now I'm writing about it.
Yeah, no, I know.
So he writes in the book, like the bad guy's like, oh, they were inept, and they thought it was an accident. But I really wanted them to know that it was me. The main character is like, Aaron is like, I want them to know that I like the attention. I hate it when I'm not being recognized for the fires that I'm setting. So I want to make sure that they know it's arson. And he doesn't even think about, it says in the book, the deaths were blotted out of his mind. It wasn't his fault. Just stupid people acting as stupid people do. Another quote I'm going to give you from this book is, is he writing like imagining what this evil fire starter did, or is he writing from the perspective of being like he really thought that? It's okay. So here's another section of the book.
It just seems like kind of like a weird, what's hard is it's a little bit damning to write it.
Yeah.
Pick another project. write a rom-com.
Write a rom-com.
Write a rom-com. Create, but they do say write what you know, and he doesn't know a lot about firebugs and arson, so it's hard. What is it? What's a creative man artistically inclined to do?
I'm going to read you this. To Aaron, the smoke was beautiful, causing his heart rate to quicken and his breathing to come in shallow gasps. He was trying to control his outward appearance and look normal to everyone around him. He looked around and saw nothing. The lot was empty. He relaxed and partially stroked his erection, watching the fire.
Oh my God. Okay, never said he was a good writer. We never said he was good at it, writing.
So John Orr grew up in Highland Park, LA. His parents got divorced when he was little.
We're going to hear a tragic backstory right now, aren't we?
There was a couple fires in the neighborhood that he watched growing up, and he was like, wow.
Oh, no.
Then he went to Eagle Rock High School, and then he joined the Air Force when he was 17. He married his high school sweetheart. He got discharged from the military and then worked for the LAPD, but he failed his psych exam.
Ooh, not great.
And the fire department was like, you're physically not able to be a firefighter. You're not cutting it, John. Yeah. So then he studied fire science. And by 1974, he was able to get a job at the Glendale Fire Department, which is one of the lower paying departments in LA. But he quickly was getting promoted and getting recognition as an arson investigator, and then eventually became captain. Let's go back to the day that he finds the tracking device on his car and thinks it's a bomb. What he doesn't know is that they have put another tracking device on him.
Oh my God.
Yes. And they have this fingerprint, so what they need is anything else. And very quickly, he is showing up at a place where then a suspicious fire shows up. And they're like, you're done. We're arresting you in December of 1991. So it was a busy year. He had his manuscript that year. Fires are getting lit. Tracking devices are getting plugged in.
Yeah.
He ends up pleading guilty to three other federal counts of arson, including putting an incendiary device in Builders Emporium in North Hollywood in 1990. A psychiatrist talks to him and says, this guy is a pyromaniac. He is never going to admit that he did this, because when he's pleading guilty, he's doing it in that way where he's like trying to get a better sentence. Or like maybe he's like admitting there's enough evidence. Outwardly, he will say that he didn't do it. So this psychiatrist says that for him, he's never going to admit he did it, because that would be admitting he'd been a failure all his life, which you're like, whoa, aggressive.
Yeah.
He gets sentenced when he gets connected to all these fires, he gets sentenced to four concurrent life sentences with no parole. But again, when he's interviewed, he's like, I'm not actually guilty. I was framed. They used the book to frame me. They didn't like the book. So they were like, this guy did it. And they're like, then why did you plead guilty? And he's like, I wanted to save my wife from bankruptcy. That's his ex-wife now. He has four ex-wives. I'm not judging. I'm just giving you facts. The FBI,
you saying you're not judging is really convincing.
When they look at his history and all the fires they think that he set, he is the most prolific serial arsonist ever. And he has all these dopey nicknames like Pillow Pyro, because he would light, you know, like cushions on fire in stores to start a fire. Frito Bandito was because he used potato chips in one of his incendiary devices.
To me, Frito feels a little bit corn chippy, but you know what?
Yeah,
I agree. It feels like, because there another one? Could I do like a ruffle muffler? Is there like
is potato there like hater?
We have to go fire. Is it? I would. It'd been Flamin' Hot. I mean, a Flamin' Hot.
Flamin' Hot Cheetos
would be a fun reference. Really? You know, I'm just thinking like it feels like Frito Bandito is fun, but unless you're using a corn chip, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
He loved the game of basically trying to set a fire in a populated place with a timed device and then getting out. That was part of the getting off on it, was like exactly what his character in the book does in a lot of ways. Where
so there
I'm gonna
is a sexual
this.
Gratification element
we
to
don't
this?
Know. I mean, we okay. don't know. We can assume from the book that that was not a creative... Like, if this person yeah. is a serial arsonist and they're writing a book where the guy that's a serial arsonist is getting sexually aroused by fires, I don't yeah. see why in the world the fantasy part is the sex and that this guy's just benignly lighting
oh
fires, wishing that he was getting turned
on
but isn't.
Victims? How many victims does he have?
I don't know. I know that he is believed to have set nearly 2,000 fires and that he did it for 30 years.
Oh, my God.
And that most of them were between 1984 and 1991. But he's the most prolific. Yes, he's the most prolific arsonist in the United States, in our history.
And you know what? I can tell you he's right about one thing. The bug was in the crowd.
The bug was in the crowd. The bug was him. He's the bug. The bug is calling from inside the house. The other thing that's wild, the reason the fire count would also probably be so high is that he would do, I think he would light multiple fires at the same time as a deliberate way. So say he'd go to a department right. store and light a fire, then I think he'd run over to a grassy area somewhere and light another fire to try to spread the firefighters out so that when he was gonna, or he'd light one, I'm going to go light a distraction fire here, then go to a store and light another bigger fire. Basically, how can I keep my fire big and unattended as long as possible so that my creation is more...
Sick. I'm so yeah. curious because the paraphilia of him doing it as a kid, right? Like of seeing these fires. I'm so mm-hmm. curious of like, because, you know, I think we've covered paraphilia in this podcast because we did it a lot on Psychology of Serial Killer, which is like the idea that There's an obsession, a something that like triggers a response in your brain. And so I'm so curious as to like when the fire happened when he was a kid, how that triggered mm-hmm. this paraphilia response.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's pyromania. We know, I know so little about
yeah.
what that is and how that begins and what the fixation is. But I think that the really interesting thing for me about this case was just the idea that he's setting all these fires and that he's the lead arson investigating chief at a bunch of them. And that he's trying to make sure
perfect
they know
crime.
It was arson. Like the idea that you would yeah. almost be getting away with it and then be like, but don't you guys think somebody did this? Because you
because
really
in that
want
store,
them to see you.
Yeah, because in the store, they were like, it's an electrical fire. And he was like, are you sure?
Well, they talk about how he'd go. The reason he was a god in that community was that he'd show up at these fires. They wouldn't be able to figure out how they started. He would explain how he thought they started, which was correct because he was the one that started them. And then he would walk through the rubble to where he pretty much knew his device was because he knew where he'd planted it. And so imagine being with him on site and everything looks trashed. And he suddenly walks over to the exact place where a device is and pulls it out of the rubble. Like he looked like
it's almost like he knew where it was
like
the whole time. I wonder how many people were suspicious of him.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's such
jump.
A thing where
like I imagine there's an Olivia Colman character who
well, that's
has always
Casey
had her eyes
for
on him.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's definitely Marvin Casey being like, I feel weird about this guy, and everybody yeah. being like, it's not a guy from our department because how bad would that look? And him having to prove
it.
Yeah,
it would look really fucking bad because it is.
It cost them.
Oh, Jesus.
It cost them in the tens of millions, these fires that he set. Just this fire chief setting fires.
Oh, my God.
Arson is the leading cause of fires in the United States. And it
oh.
is the second leading cause of fire deaths.
That's interesting. Arson is leading, so a random fire is much less
is
common.
Less likely than an arsonist starting a
wow,
fire.
Wow,
that Isn't
feels
that,
that is a really interesting statistic.
In doing this research was interesting because a lot of the articles that talk about John Orr talk about him in the context of talking about the larger problem of arson and stories about firemen that set fires to become heroes. So, and then it's John Orr's a different story. He wants it to burn as long as possible, yeah. And he doesn't seem to care if anybody dies. It's
well, his motive is different. The motive is to have the fire versus someone who the motive is to be a hero.
Right. And then you have these stories about people that set fires to put them out, and then the fire gets out of control, and that wasn't what they intended. They wanted it to be big enough that you'd notice them putting it out, but not big enough that it became a real problem.
It feels a little bit Munchausen by proxy in a weird way.
Yes, it does. That's so true. And creating this way to feel like the lead in the story, to feel important.
You guys, either go to therapy or write a solo show. It's really like there's better options than starting a fucking fire.
It seems like
fire.
John was trying to do, to John's credit, it does seem like he was trying to do both. He was... definitely wanted to publish this really terrible book about fire sex.
This like smutty fire book. Jesus Christ. God damn it. Why are people? Ugh. People be peopling, man.
We don't like it.
We all right. Don't
and that's the
like
story
it.
Of Firebug, John Leonard Orr.
Thanks for telling that story, Quinn.
Anytime.
I think it's time we record the Patreon. So we got to run and it's got to be August Patreon.
Let's do it.
Time. Hey, bye y'all. See you next week.